Session number 12778.
General Martin Real 2.
The company plan for...
You were just saying the weather got rough, I think.
The weather got distinctly rough and choppy, but we consoled ourselves with the thought that maybe the enemy wouldn't expect us to land in seas as they were becoming. It was really almost a forerunner of what was to happen from the Normandy invasion next year, a year later. Now, the plan for my particular company was to support 151 Brigade, which was to be the assault brigade for 50 Div. And 151 Brigade was to land with two battalions up, 6 DLI on the left and 9 DLI on the right, and they were to secure the beaches at Avola, A-V-O-L-A, and form a tight bridgehead on the high ground around Avola. The 8th DLI were then to also secure the high ground overlooking Avola from the west. The initial plan was for the company to send one platoon up to join each of these three battalions as soon as they had landed. And we would then take it from there as to what was to happen next, according to the amount of opposition which was going to meet us. We had every reason to believe that they were Italian troops in the coastal defences, and from past experience we didn't expect them to put up a very great resistance, but we did expect to meet German troops as we pressed in from the beaches. I went up on deck in the early hours. We'd been woken at midnight. Each hour was supposed to be an 0245 hours, and we'd been woken at midnight. And shortly after that, the Indonesian waiters went round with their gongs tinkling for breakfast. And we went up for breakfast in the saloons and had bacon and eggs and coffee and toast and marmalade. And it all seemed extremely unreal to think that we were about to land on a foreign coast. When breakfast was over, I went down to see the rest of the company, who were assembled on F2 deck. Rum ration was issued, cocoa ad infinitum available from the ship's galley. Found everybody in very good form, but it was still very hard to realise the task in front. I went up on deck, and one could just see the faint outline of the coast ahead, and particularly an enormous, lowering black mass, which was obviously Mount Etna. And the ships were moving very slowly by now, and we could see a fire burning somewhere way to the west, and then bombers, or I imagine also aircraft towing gliders, came overhead with their lights on. I mentioned, I said that in my war diary at the time, bombers with lights burning roared overhead, but I imagine these were more likely to be in navigation lights to ensure that they didn't crash into each other. The ship then stopped, and the first flight was lowered away, of assault landing craft lowered away. And there was then a very long period of waiting. A searchlight from the shore swept the water and hesitated and then went out. So we thought for a moment that the assault craft going in had been spotted. But nothing happened. We were due to, in fact, be landed at 0420 ourselves, the company, the assault flight having gone in at 02:45. But nothing happened. We were still standing to. Dawn came and we were still waiting. And daylight brought a fantastic sight. The morning sun shining on all the white houses and the white towns and villages ashore, while out to sea, as far as the eye could see, were ships of all sizes steadily closing in towards the beaches. The divisional front, the 6th GLI were due to land on Jig Amber Beach and the 9th GLI on Jig Green Beach, with the 5th Division on our right. And it was fairly apparent something had gone wrong. There was very little firing or any noise like that from the shore, but one could see through binoculars people crisscrossing from left and right and right to left. And what had in fact happened was most people had been landed on the wrong beaches, so that 9 DLI had been landed on 5 Division beaches, 5 Division battalions had been landed on our beaches, and thankfully there was precious little opposition. But it meant that everybody was crisscrossing to get back onto their proper beaches before anybody else came ashore. Finally, at about 6:30 in the morning, the platoon, which was due to join up with the 8th GLI and to push inland a bit from Avola, set off in an LCI, Landing Craft Infantry, with a company of the 8th GLI, the shore being still about 7 miles away. At 8:00, the remainder of the company embarked, and this was quite tricky. We had to go down scrambling nets into these landing craft personnel, which were bobbing up and down on this considerable sea alongside us. And one or two people had nasty falls into the bottom. And as everybody was heavily laden with kit, it was not a very happy little operation. However, we did it. And eventually, about half an hour later, we made the shore to find the water was only knee deep and didn't present any difficulty in spite of our heavy loads. And we were carrying our 12 belts of gun, which we'd been practicing with. Now, the transport we had been allocated was not very much. I told you earlier on about the terrible transport we had when we first went to the desert. After the Ghazala handicap and before Alamein, we'd been completely equipped with brand new transport. And we had been given jeeps down to platoon commanders for reconnaissance. And we've been used to, therefore, to a fairly plush scale of transport. Now, suddenly, for the company, our allocation was 7 1500-weight trucks. A platoon normally had 4 1500-weight trucks. But we had 7 1500-weight trucks for 3 platoons and company headquarters for reserve ammunition and so on. And on the landing, in fact, we lost our water cart and we lost one of the 1500-weights, so we were down to 6 1500-weight trucks, which was not easy. In addition, I had a jeep and I had been given a Daimler Dingo scout car, which was a tremendous luxury and very exciting. But fortunately it did mean that having two vehicles you could reuse for reconnaissance, that I could use one and the second in command of the company could use others, the other, to try and find out where we were when he would bring up supplies and so on. But only two 1500-weights per platoon meant that if one was being used by the platoon commander for reconnaissance, then the other had to have all the gun kit on it and two gun numbers per gun, the number one and the number two, and everybody else had to walk. The move into the assembly area went very smoothly. and the platoons of 6 and 90 line joined up. To our surprise, the platoon which had left the ship with the 8th DLI company some 2 hours before us didn't land for about 2 hours after we got there, because they'd been landed in 5 Division beaches and had to walk all the way around. However, everybody by 2 o'clock in the afternoon was in the right place. There had been very little opposition. We had a slightly worrying time with one platoon when they bumped some soldiers who opened fire, who turned out to be American paratroops who had been dropped on the totally wrong area. They were supposed to be in southwest Sicily and had been dropped over southeast Sicily. We had, cruising in, seen quite a number of gliders in the water with bodies around and one or two people swimming. Again, the dropping of glider troops had not gone entirely well. But as far as the brigade was concerned, everything seemed to be okay. Unfortunately, that afternoon, we lost one truck when the recce party of my number 6 platoon, preparing to support the 9th DLI down the road from Albano to Noto, got ambushed and shot up. And although the soldiers on it were miraculously unscathed, the truck was a write-off, which meant that that platoon was down to only one truck for the rest of the campaign. So that all its ammunition, all its gun kit, its numbers 1 and 2 on each gun, that's 8 gun numbers, had to travel on that truck, and everyone else in the platoon was going to have to walk from there onwards. Lieutenant Dupre, who commanded that platoon, was an interesting character. He was a Jerseyman who got away from Jersey in the last boat just before the Germans occupied the Channel Islands. He was his family owned a great fish business in Jersey. He himself had been a very fine athlete and a very good boxer. He had a squash nose of a boxer. He had very bandy legs. He was a tough character. And he was, after the war, to go on to become Minister of Tourism for Jersey and a distinguished member of the States, the government of Jersey. That day ended with Noto being on the point of being secured, and we all camped for that night, or were in position that night around Avola, and Avola Noto. The next day we moved up to a place called Cassibile, and the form at this time was that the 5th Division on our right were advancing along the coast road, Syracuse, Augusta, to secure those ports, and along the main coast road from Lentini to Syracuse. 50 Div were moving on a secondary road running through very hilly country to the southwest of the main coast road, with 69 Brigade on the left and 151 Brigade on the right. And we came face to face with countryside which was totally unlike anything we were used to. Accustomed to fighting in the wonderful open spaces of the desert, where movement was possible anywhere. And if you got shot up, you could get out of the way fairly rapidly. We were suddenly in an area which was covered with vineyards and olive trees. There were little narrow lanes bounded by high stone walls, very hilly, uphill and downhill roller coaster sort of stuff, hairpin bends, wonderful country for ambushing or for defence. Very limited field of fire for our machine guns, and everybody had to walk. There was no more riding in trucks as we'd all been used to in the desert. And that affected the infantry as well, who had become very mechanised, and even if they had to drive and go everywhere 3 tonners in the desert, at least they drove most places. But now we were down to a real infantry staff, and that was quite a shock. The compensation, of course, was the fact that we were in Europe. We really felt it was the beginning of the end. There were these lovely almond trees. One could pick the almonds off the trees, and plums, and everywhere the vineyards full of grapes, so that you could set your thirst at any time. But the vineyards were difficult to get through. The vines might be anything up to 3 to 5 feet high, with the rows packed fairly closely together. So if you had to go to a vineyard, you were limited in the amount of movement on either way which you could take. But on the 11th of July, having moved north to Gasibele area, we ended up that day with, I had two platoons with the Durham Light Infantry and one platoon with number 3 Commando. And I only mention that because at this time, because we were moving on narrow axes of advances, and because there was a pretty good confusion, not only amongst, because various brigades and battalions tended to get channeled so that they met up with each other instead of keep their proper line. The enemy also were in a state of considerable confusion, and there were German and Italian troops all mixed up with us, that as we moved forward we might find that behind us there was a German strong point which nobody had noticed, which then opened up on the people behind, and so on. And my platoons, I was having to move from battalion to battalion, not only just within 151 Brigade, the Durham Brigade, but to 69 Brigade, 5th East Yorks, Greenhards, and so on, and to support little company attacks on isolated strong points which had been left over by people who had gone forward before, or which suddenly opened up as we moved forward. On the following day, I just mentioned this because it was just typical of the sort of thing that would happen. I was went off with the brigade recce party to meet the brigadier north of a small town called Songarino. The way we operated was that the brigade commander would go off with his tactical, small tactical headquarters, which usually consisted of himself, perhaps a gunner or a battery commander, and sometimes myself, and to recce, to find out what the situation was in the front and decide on his plan. And the brigade orders group would then go up forward to meet the brigadier, and that consisted of the commanding officers of the battalions and the commanding officer of the anti-tank battery and so on, and the engineers. We would go forward and be given our orders for an attack or whatever it was, and then we in the meantime would have ordered our own recce parties to come forward to meet us, so that as soon as we got our orders we could get them doing their reconnaissances and so on. It's what's called battle drill, and it's designed to try and get everybody doing something at the same time to speed up the mounting of an operation. And anyhow, at 11 o'clock that morning I went off with the brigade recce party to meet the brigadier north of San Marino, and we had to pass through a small town called Floridia and got heavily mortared going through it. And we met up with the brigadier north of San Marino, where we met also the Enniskilling Fusiliers, part of 5 Div, which somebody or another had cut across our front. And we were going to relieve them so that they could go back onto their proper axis. And the Inniskillings told us the enemy were infiltrating on all sides, that the road we'd just come up was now cut off, and that Solerino had been reoccupied by the enemy. That was just behind us. So I had, in the meantime, it's ordered my platoon commanders to come up and meet me at Floridia, which was behind Solerino, and I did a detour around a little secondary road to avoid Solerino, and this these people had got in there again. And just as I came into Floridia, by the road from Solerino, down the road came a small two-man Italian tank. They had a lot of these little baby tanks, which are no larger than a small motor car, but which had a gun on. And I was in the dingo at the time, and this Italian tank was coming straight towards me. And suddenly, for no particular reason, he swerved and hit a lamppost. And that brought him to a shuddering halt, and all was well. But I discovered that he had, just up the other end of Floridia, he had met the 6th DLI, who were advancing into Floridia, and had shot up the commanding officer's jeep with the commanding officer inside it, which had shaken the commanding officer up considerably. And things went on like that. We tried to collect some transport. Company headquarters arrived, I see, up with me on the night of the 12th of July, preceded by scouts on bicycles, at a fast trot led by the colour sergeant in a very smart gig and pony trap. Which he used, and thereafter considerably, for dishing out rations and things like that. And various other platoons had managed to get hold of the odd Fiat one-tonner and things like that. Well, we went on like this, continually having little battles, and collecting a little bit more transport. The situation was extremely confused, but during the 14th of July, I went forward with the Brigadier Senior, who had taken over command of the brigade from Brigadier Beak, who had got sacked after the Battle of Marath. Brigadier Senior was, if I remember rightly, a guards officer. He had been commanded a machine gun company in his battalion before the reorganization in machine gun battalions took place, and reckoned he was a pretty fair whiz kid on machine guns, and he was, I think, a very good brigade commander, but I found him not a terribly easy person to get on with, particularly because one was aware the whole time that he was thinking to himself, I wouldn't have done that with my machine guns. But he was a good brigade commander, there's no doubt about that. And I went forward with him to the hills overlooking Carlentini and Lentini, which had been cleared by 69 Brigade during the previous night, because 151 Brigade had been given the order to pass through 69 Brigade and make for the Primosole Bridge over the River Somito, which was the key to the advance on Catania. And this bridge had been seized, as far as we knew, the night before by a parachute brigade, British Parachute Brigade, or Airborne Brigade, which was to have dropped round the bridge and seized it so that the Division 50 could then proceed through and strike rapidly up to Catania. I remember that day well because It was the only day when we had really bad air opposition, and in fact quite a lot of damage was done to soldiers and transport, including our own C Company, which lost a great number of machine gun carriers and was really down to about one platoon for the rest of the Sicily campaign. Well, we had hardly got to the observation post, the Brigadier and I, when 9 DLI arrived, having had a long march up the winding pass behind us. And the Brigadier ordered them to send forward a mobile column under the second in command of the battalion, Major Robinson, to contact the paratroops on the bridge. As I say, as far as we knew, they had landed on the night of the 13th, 14th, and as far as we knew, they were still there this day, the 14th of July. So I sent off Dupre and his platoon with all the guns and Dupre himself and the numbers 1 and 2 on his four guns on and all his ammunition on this 1,500-weight truck, while the rest of his gun numbers, that is the 3, 4 and 5 on each gun, the ammunition numbers, they had to march with the 9th DLI. And this mobile column got up to about a mile away from the Primsele Bridge, where they bumped into the parachutists. The column had in the meantime picked up two squadrons of Sherman tanks on the coast road, which they had hit at Lantini, and two squadrons of tanks from 4th Armoured Brigade, which had been with 5 Div. So these two squadrons and the small mobile column, which consisted of two sections of Bren gun carriers, a troop of 6-pounders from the Northumberland Fusiliers anti-tank gun battery, and our own little platoon, number 6 platoon, they all speeded up there and arrived, as I say, just short of the Primsele Bridge, to be met by the airborne people who had had to abandon the bridge only 2 hours previously. The parachutists had largely been dropped in the wrong place, and although some had straddled in from all over North Sicily during the day, they didn't have enough to hold the bridge against the very stiff opposition being put in by German paratroopers. What they were able to do was to remove the charges from the bridge so it couldn't immediately be blown.